This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Michael. Welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each episode we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. We are here at the season finale of our Summer Impossible season talking about Barbie, the winner of our vote between Barbie and Oppenheimer. Barbie, the 2023 film written by Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach and directed by Greta Gerwig. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Ryan Bittner.
Hi, Ken.
Hi, Ken. And Alex Kayotos.
Hi, Ken.
Okay, super excited to talk about this movie. Before we dive in, so yes, we are at the end of our summer season, Summer Impossible season. It has been a blast. We had a vote open the whole time, essentially, and it was a fight between Barbie and Oppenheimer. Barbie won. We're talking about it. We are going to be talking about Oppenheimer with our top-tier patrons in our film club next Saturday, so August 12th. I think that math works out. We're recording ahead of time. So excited to talk about that over there with the patrons. And so what does it mean that we did this season also? So what it means is that we went hard for the summer. We're going to take a break for a few weeks. There's still going to be patron exclusives released. So if you still want your fix of us talking about movies and sharing thoughts and giggling, head over to the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon and support us there. It's only $2 a month. Any support would be very welcome. And Patreon now has a free tier where you can just join the community and we make public posts. You'll be notified of it. And so that would also be a great way for you to follow what's happening in this little mini off period as we get ready to announce what our next season, when it starts and what it's about. You can be the first to know over on the Patreon. We have a pretty clear idea. We're pretty excited about it. That will be coming in the future.
As long as nothing changes. In yes. The world. Yes.
In the world.
Hollywood gives us our movies, God damn it.
Listen, solidarity with the strike.
Absolutely.
And no. If we all have to suffer a little bit so that everybody gets a fair deal, then we will all suffer, but we will complain about it.
I think they should still release the movies and also pay the actors and the writers. How about we just do that?
Yeah, let's do it all.
Everybody wins. Dune. All right, so.
I'm so mad.
Hang in there, everybody.
Anyway, Barbie. Okay, so I had avoided all trailers. You could not avoid the marketing of this movie. So I saw lots of pink. I knew, obviously, Margot Robbie, Greta Gerwig, Ryan Gosling. But otherwise, I had no idea what this movie was going to be, what it was going to be about, what kind of a story could they put in a Barbie movie that was going to make sense. I was super confused and very interested going into it. And I had so much fun in this movie. This movie is so, so good. I was truly blown away. I laughed. I cried. I felt all the emotions. The story that they managed to tell, like, really worked for me. Went to some like deep places and just had a lot of like authenticity and heart, while also being super fun and funny and just an enjoyable ride, start to finish. So I was astonished by all of this. I'm so, so impressed by the script and the directing and the act, like all of this just came together to create something that feels to me very special and unique and kind of throwbacky in a way. Like, it felt like a summer movie from like our teen years, where it was just like a fun movie, and it's not setting up, you know, a crazy, you know, 10 episode Avengers stuff. Like, it just told a story, and it's, you know, it's based on an IP, but it still felt like an original story, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like there's a Barbie story that it's based on. So I thought it was just like incredible, and I'm blown away. Greta Gerwig is now 3 for 3. That's a pretty good track record. I'm very excited about anything and everything that she does moving forward. Yeah, so much fun. Very interested to hear from you guys. There's some cool structural character arc things I want to talk about. Yeah, just a lot of cool stuff, but I want to hear from people. Trisha, what are your thoughts?
I'm with you. I just had a... I was knocked over. I just loved this movie so, so, so much. I was sitting directly next to Alex. I think I probably scared Alex with how much I was laughing. I just thought it was so funny, and spoke directly to me in so many ways. I had, yeah, like you, avoided the trailer, so I didn't know what it was. I had a suspicion it was going to be a fish out of water story, but it was so much more than that. And I can't get over how refreshing and unique it feels. Like, the vision behind this movie feels so singular, and just like this window being thrown open into Hollywood right now, where like everything else just feels like drudgery and like a facsimile of a facsimile of a movie. And this just felt like something actually visionary and original, as you said. Now, yeah, it is based on one of the most famous toys in the world. And there is some like corporate presence in the movie, quite certainly. Literally. His name's Will Ferrell. anyway, but at the same time, it feels like the only movie that you could like work with that in. You know, we talked a lot about in the new or most recent Matrix film, how there's a lot of like textual engagement with what it means to be like a new Matrix movie right now. And I felt like the Wachowskis in that movie just went ahead and didn't, like, they just didn't make a movie because they didn't have to, you know what I mean? But this actually feels like it is a movie, but it's also it's such a movie, and it's really telling a story, and it really exists truly in its own world. But also has so much to say to us in our world, where it just feels like it's doing that thing at the same time where there is a meta factor to it, but it's so loving and it welcomes you so much into just being the person that you are in 2023 and being in this timeline and what the hell is going on and what does it mean to sit in a movie in this place in our own time and engage with some of these ideas in a fictional way, but like in a truly fictional way. It's, you know, this sort of fable, this beautiful pink feminist fable, that I just loved all the way down to its core. And, yeah, I can't wait. Like, I can't wait to talk about it with you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Okay. Alex, what about you? Since you were sitting next to Trisha, circle back. Yeah.
Like, this movie right from the beginning, when you go into Barbie land, just the art design is so impeccable. You can feel Greta Gerwig like kind of loves these toys and had these toys and has a nostalgia for like every little detail of the Barbie dream house and the costumes. And it's just such a visual delight to be in that world. So yeah, when this movie started and also her directing, you know, confidence and her style and the way everything flows in that first act, I'm just like, okay, this is fantastic. I am so on board for this ride. I am so down with this movie. And as it was, you know, the problem arose, you know, feelings about death and cellulite and all of it just felt so brilliant, the way the problem was introduced and the kind of Toy Story-ish, you know, connection to the kid and the journey to the real world. Ken tagging along. And the movie felt like it was, to me, I had these expectations at a certain point that this was going to be next level in its examination of men and women in society, almost like in a Get Out kind of way. I was ready for like, oh, we're going to like new places. This is going to be like the Get Out, but like for women. It was maybe like this unrealistic, like Greta Gerwig, like idea I had in my head at a certain point. And then once we got to the second half of the movie with the kingdom and the patriarchy, it was kind of the little boy version of everything. And I realized on the second viewing, that's probably quite intentional, that both Ken's journey is kind of like a little boy discovering patriarchy. We've got Barbie as the little girl discovering, oh God, the real world sucks. And it all plugs in. But in my first viewing, I was actually getting disappointed by the kind of overt and absurd versions of, you know, patriarchy and the kind of the solution to it at the end. I didn't quite understand like what was solved or how the Just Ken song resolved things. And so there was kind of like, I was at a mismatch with the movie at some point where I didn't quite plug in to the exact allegory and the exact, you know, way it was conceiving of these big heady ideas. It was so crazy and amazing that Greta Gerwig got this into a toy movie, into like a Mattel corporate toy movie. Right. So on the one hand, it's a miracle and it's amazing and it's so brilliant and great. On the other hand, I had such high expectations. The mismatch of what she actually did was like bothering me. I saw it again today, knowing what it is, and it all plugged in so much better because I did see this movie as allegory for basically both like young boys and girls emerging from the world of toys, of like innocent childhood dream reality into the real world and like what happens then. And so I think it's exactly what Greta Gerwig wants it to be and is doing exactly what she wants it to be. And I think there was an element of my first viewing, and I still feel a little bit that if you're going to go all the way to Kendom and you're going to go all the way to like your finale being the Just Ken song, I just didn't quite feel, I wanted Noah Baumbach to get in there and like do a more honest, like what's wrong with men, like assessment, whereas we got kind of like a shallower feeling assessment that left me a little bit wanting. But everything else in the movie is just so damn good, and it is such like a primal like scream in so many ways that is so cathartic. And of course, summed up in that America Ferrera monologue, which is so good. Mm-hmm. So the movie accomplishes so much, and it's one of those things where when a movie is this good and does this much right, when there's a part that bumps, it like bothers me more than it should. So anyway, that's my complicated feelings about this movie. And maybe you guys can convince me that it's not bumpy and that I'm missing something, but that's my starting place for this conversation. All these things.
I do think it's a little more sophisticated than you're giving it credit for.
Sure.
But we can come back to it.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. Well, and that this is a point of discussion for a toy movie, as you said, it's an amazing miracle. A lot to get into.
Just like the assignment was to make a movie for Mattel about Barbie, and Greta Gerwig like managed to do this amazing.
Right,
and it's the highest grossing movie for a female filmmaker opening weekend ever. Like,
nice.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, and we can get into this too, but also like Margot Robbie as a producer, it being her project, she approached, like, I think there's just
she's
a lot
very
of
responsible
really,
for this.
Smart decisions that, I really respect by the team working on this. Brian, what was your thoughts? I was sitting next to you. We giggled a lot.
Yeah. It's real quick to pick it up from the point that was just being made. I think I have a sort of sinking feeling that happens when it's like, hey, you know that filmmaker who just made that really cool, like, you know, out of left field, interesting movie? They're now doing the next franchise here movie, you know? And it's like, okay, so I have to wait how many years for Barry Jenkins to make another Barry Jenkins movie because he's making the next Lion King, and that might be a good movie, but where's my, you know? And like, man, Greta Gerwig made a Greta Gerwig movie, right? Like that was the best thing. It is exactly what you guys are talking about. I think there was some interviewer who said, you know, oh, is this like kind of a selling out? Like, are you just doing the thing? And she's like, no, you can do the thing and subvert the thing. And like, that's exactly what she did here is she made more of a Greta Gerwig movie than she made a Barbie movie. And like that in my mind is the best possible thing about this. And to the other point you guys were making, like Mattel allowed themselves to be like the John Malkovich of being John Malkovich in this movie, right? We're like, we're gonna play a sort of crazy version of ourselves in this movie. And I loved all that. But yeah, in terms of my actual experience with the movie, I mean, there's no better way to see this movie than with an adorable, high-pitched, like, giggle next to you. And I sat next to Michael. So that's exactly what I got for every 15 seconds, just a giggle fest. It was infectious. And yeah, I mean, this movie is so fun and so smart, you know. And we talked during Across the Spider-Verse, we talked about movies that are like, it's like the lines that are happening off screen between the lines are brilliant and hilarious. And it's like, if you're not paying attention, you know, then the lines that are happening in the songs that are singing during the montage are like, they're hilarious and like that, whatever. And this movie is just, it's just so smart and so clever. It almost like what Alex was saying, if there's anything I bumped on, it was the times when it was being just a little goofy for goofiness sake, where I was just like, oh, but like everything you are doing is so, so good that when it's just kind of being like a little wacky, I'm like, oh, this is fine. I don't dislike it at all. But, you know, this movie is not for me in terms of like tone stuff. This movie should not be for me. So if there are certain times where the tone is not like quite for me, that's, I am totally fine with that because this movie is amazing. And 98% of the time I was just on pink cloud nine, just really having a blast. And then there's an interesting conversation to be had about, you guys mentioned Toy Story, but like this Elf and Lego Movie and Barbie, almost like sub genre of movie where like this character lives in a perfect world, but like they don't know the real world exists. And then at some point something happens in their perfect world and they have to go like synthesize with the real world. Also, Will Ferrell is always in all of those movies. So it's some he somehow is making right. all of this happen. So yeah, there's a lot to get into, but ultimately it's just like, I'm so happy this movie is what this movie is. And there's a lot more I want to get into later that I don't want to talk about just yet. But this could have been a schlocky movie that was just for a much younger audience. This could have been a movie that was sort of surface level in terms of what it was doing, you know, and the fact that it was just like, no, we're going hard and we're making an audience kind of for like 30-year-olds, like 35-year-olds, you know what I mean? Like even like the music choices, it's like, we all know Matchbox 20 is not very good, right? Like, let's all make a movie about.
How dare you? They were my favorite band in high school.
I want to push you around.
The Rob Thomas impression is unreal. It's so good. It's very, very good.
Well.
But yeah, just ton of fun. It's such a smart movie. And so like Barbie versus Oppenheimer, like these movies are so dense. Like I'm like, I think Barbie right. might be even more dense than Oppenheimer in terms of just me being like, I'm still unpacking things and still kind of like entire sequences where I barely remember the like meat of it because just the surface stuff was already, there was so much going on. So yeah, excited to talk about it now and excited to like watch the movie again at a later date.
Wouldn't it be nice to have a curated selection of unique films from around the world, hand-selected by expert curators who are passionate about elevating great cinema? Why, yes, it would, and yes, it is. It's called MUBI. MUBI is a streaming service where each and every film is hand-selected. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. And here to tell us about one such discovery you can find on MUBI is our very own Brian Binder. Brian.
Well, hello. I recently was watching some Ingmar Bergman films that I hadn't seen before. Wild Strawberries, Cries and Whispers, and Persona. And just very interesting films that are pretty short, like 90 minutes. And just they're very dense and always just like metaphors on life. And Bergman feels like one of those filmmakers where studying his films is almost as interesting as watching them. And watching them is pretty interesting too. So there is a documentary on MUBI called Searching for Ingmar Bergman. And just a different interviews with other filmmakers and talking about Bergman and his films. And so if you, like me, are someone who is interested in Bergman and interested in hearing what other people have to say about his films, you can check that documentary out on MUBI.
Very nice. Yes. And you can do so because with a free 30-day trial, you can experience MUBI's entire library of films for yourself. And by signing up, you're also supporting Beyond the Screenplay and helping us to continue to make new episodes. So why not try MUBI for free today? Just head to MUBI.com/beyondthescreenplay to start your free trial and discover a whole world of great cinema. That's MUBI.com/beyondthescreenplay. Thank you to MUBI for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Yeah. I think the question of audience is really interesting because I think it is clearly made for adults to be able to appreciate, but I think it's also made for like teens and tweens to appreciate. And so I think anytime there were these kind of moments that were sort of like hovering around, that's like, oh, this feels maybe more like reductive than I would like it to be. I felt like it was always in the service of the theme and being very clear about the meaning behind it being accessible like universally. Mm-hmm. And so we can talk about all that more. This movie is so smart. And Brian, I think you said that there was an interview where she said, well, yeah, you can do the thing and subvert the thing. And the first thought I had was like, no, you can do that, Greta Gerwig. Like, that is not an easy thing to achieve and pull off here. And coming out of it and watching it, I felt like, and I still haven't put my finger on it, I'm going to find the screenplay at one point and break it down all the way. But there's, I think, like a new archetypal story structure that's like emerging for me in this movie, as far as like a modern take on character arcs and antagonists and how you want to express modern themes that I think movies have tried to do. Like, I think there's kind of a Disney performative version of, you know, modern morality that gets expressed on a surface level in some of the recent outings. But I feel like this movie earns all the ups and downs and all of the, you know, Ken goes all the way to antagonist, but like is then saved and kind of like finds his own place. The way this movie pulls all of that off, I just totally bought and totally I was on that ride, and it felt organic and it felt emotional at every step and authentic and viewed with eyes open. And so I'm just kind of blown away by the architecture of the story and the journey that it takes all the characters on.
Yeah, I was stunned when I realized that Ken was getting a character arc as well. Mm. It was not at all what I expected when the movie began. And even though I think the structure of this is flawless, and that includes like setting up Ken's arc from like the very first few minutes of the movie, because, you know, it's all there. And I'm sure Alex, having watched it twice, you were able to appreciate that even more in the first act. But it just like, you know, at first when I watched it, the moments with Ken that become of great importance later didn't immediately announce themselves to me as being about Ken. And because they announced them, they're also about Barbie. And that is such a feat. Like, if you're going into this just tracking Barbie's character arc, those scenes are so efficient that they feel absolutely full to the brim of stuff for Barbie. But they're also doing stuff for Ken as well, setting up his entire arc and the sort of secondary thematic exploration of how patriarchy harms men. And then like, what do we do about that in terms of gender roles? And so I was just so impressed by that when I was thinking back on it. You know, there are really these two moments at the Barbie Dreamhouse scene where they're having the big party there. And Barbie has her, do you guys ever think about dying moment, which is great.
I was so happy in that moment. That was the first time amazing. The movie was like, hey, we're going to do stuff. Yeah. And I didn't know that was coming. I was like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is very clearly like, here we are at the inciting incident, you know, and I didn't look at my watch, but I was like, I bet you this is on page 15 of the screenplay. I'm desperate to read the screenplay, by the way.
Yes.
But then the scene right after that, you know, Ken tries to dance to get Barbie's attention. It doesn't really work. That happens. The scene right after that is when he tries to stay over and she tells him it's girls' night. And there's this very specific rejection that's happening that immediately sets up his arc. But the way that those scenes kind of fit together at the end of that day, right? Like, it's sort of the perfect, here's the world as the characters know it. Here's all the different dynamics that are in play and blah, blah, blah. In addition to the best production and costume design you've maybe ever seen ever. And these incredible sets and all this stuff. And then here are these very definitive character moments for Barbie. There's this work that's being done for Ken as well, so that when his story starts to emerge in the second act and you get into like, I'm just going to pop into the library here and see what books they have about cars or whatever. I'm just going to see if they have any book about trucks. Yeah. Oh, it's so good. But yeah, it's very much like that's kind of been there all along. It's very deft structure work.
Yeah.
That really struck me, the sort of the two story worlds in this movie and how they're each constructed for the two, obviously, genders being represented in this movie, which is like, let's imagine a world where women have like all the power and men are sort of okay with it, ? But like, maybe not. And then they see the real world where for Barbie, it's like this crisis of, oh, wait, this is how like women are actually treated in the real world. But then also for Ken is like, wait a minute, we can have power. Like that's possible for us to have power. And then that's what starts his sort of antagonist arc there, you know? So I thought it was a really, really smart way to sort of make the Barbie verse be like this mirror reflection of the real world.
Well, something that watching it a second time, the layers of this film became more clear to me and were so impressive, where you've got this kind of, you know, it's not well-defined rules of the universe where these are correlates of dolls in the real world. Maybe that, you know, if you get cut up and, you know, smashed around, you become weird Barbie. But it's so brilliant watching those early scenes and just thinking about this, the way these characters behave in Barbie Land is, you know, there's a Toy Story element to it where a little girl playing with Barbie wants to have the Barbie girls' night sleepover party. She does not know what Ken would do if he were there. So Ken is going to leave now because we're having girls' night. And I think that it was so much fun to see how the meta remembering of what it was like to play with toys, what little girls actually do with their Barbies as part of the story world, as fueling the conflict with Ken, which is just so brilliant how many layers are at work in every part of this movie. And I really appreciated that in the first act this time around.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really smart decision to open it in Barbie world, right? Because, and without explaining the rules to an unnecessary degree, because in order for the story to work, we absolutely have to think of Barbie as being a person essentially with agency. So when Barbie doesn't know what's going wrong with her, or when she makes any decision, it's critical that we as the audience see that as being an autonomous decision that she is making, right? Like, so her decision not to want to have Ken stay over has to come across as Barbie is making this decision herself, and or, you know, doesn't care when Ken gets hurt, when he runs into the plastic wave on the beach, or doesn't, you know, just wants to dance, except when she has that moment when she thinks about death. And so, like, it's absolutely necessary for the character journey for her to have sentience. And tipping your hand at all by engaging with the human person behind it would destroy that. It is a Toy Story problem, or like a Toy Story analogous to that sort of an idea. Like, we can't think too much about Andy, right? Like, because Andy in the Toy Story universe would ruin everything if we actually stopped and thought about him for 10 seconds and what his real relationship is to the personality of Woody or Buzz right. or something like that.
Right.
And so the fact that we do end up meeting Sasha and her mother later, it's wise to save that because the first act of the movie has to be rock solid as being about the characters' journeys, which means they have to be characters, you know, in the traditional sense.
And I think what's great is that, yeah, I never think, even when you learn some of the hazy rules, I never think that anybody's ever controlling Barbie, but I love that the values of the world are the values of like a young, bright girl who thinks the world is amazing and has a collection of all the Barbies living the perfect world. And I think that is right. what is so kind of beautiful about Barbie Land is that there's an innocence and like an optimism and like a just a kind of, yeah, it's like a really excited about life and the future and anything's possible, which is part of the Mattel Barbie dream being sold, but is also a real experience for the kind of like post tragedy young girl, you know, pre, you know, being looked at as Barbie gets looked at as when she enters the world, pre like realizing, oh, wait, there is no woman president. There is no, you know, the people that are in power are not me. And I think it's just, it's beautiful that Barbie Land seems to embody that innocence, that yeah. kind of pre-realizing innocence.
Exactly.
I really like that Barbie Land goes on a journey also. Like I was thinking about yeah. Groundhog Day as a movie that we mm-hmm. sometimes cite where the protagonist is clearly flawed and really doesn't want to change. And the movie doesn't like try to paint over that or try to like make you too much get on his side. Like I think the refusal of the call, quote unquote, is a beat that should be strong and underlined. And, you know, the character doesn't want to change because the world that they're living in this normal world is so perfect for them and isn't reinforcing their lie, quote unquote, flaw, quote unquote. So I really like the Barbie doesn't want to change at first because like this world is perfect. Why would you want to change? And like, I love that scene with Kate McKinnon where she like
the shoes
like, so, like that's hilarious, but it's also like a very clear, like a very, very clear refusal of the call. No, I choose that too. I want to go back to like, no, you have to, sorry, you're doing this wrong, Barbie. You're like the protagonist of our story. You have to change. Like, I loved all that. Cause I feel like it pulls me into her world and makes her feel like an honest person again, like that making her feel human with agency. Of course you wouldn't want to leave her change. Everything's perfect. And so I like that then also by the end, you know, Ken takes over, things go crazy and things go back to the way they were kind of, but like with a little bit of like tweaks to it where like the Kens have a little bit more, you know, feeling of purpose. They apologize to Weird Barbie for calling her Weird Barbie. Like there's a little bit of like maturing that happens even in Barbie Land that kind of pushes it a little bit more toward equality. And it's like a subtle change, but I like that Barbie Land goes on that journey partially because that also means we get to spend more time in Barbie Land. And I just love Barbie Land because it's so much fun.
It was sad to leave.
Yeah.
That to me is maybe the most interesting thing about this movie. And I was having a hard time finding another movie that really that it really reminded me of, where ordinarily, you know, you have the inciting incident, the call, right? And you have the refusal of the call, as you point out. And then you have the departure. And, you know, you go it as you move into the break into two in the second act. And ordinarily, that's in my notes or like in my outline structure in my head, that's why I call that the point of no return, right? Like you or the end of the world as we know it is another great way to think about that. And it's usually a physical leaving of a place and never to go back there until the very end of the movie.
Right.
And so the fact that we don't spend that much time, the bulk of the second act, I guess, in the real world, but the whole third act is in Barbie Land. It's not just like a little coda at the end where she goes back or something. Mm-hmm. That was a hard time. I had a hard time thinking of a comp for that in my mind. But it works really well here for all the reasons that you're pointing out. Like, we go back there basically at the midpoint. Ken goes back right. there, and then we see what has happened upon his return. It's ordinarily because as you're saying, the world at the beginning of the story is so comfortable for the protagonist. So to return to it, it has to have had a makeover in order for it to work structurally and thematically. And so it's brilliant. And also, yeah, it gives the production design again, like, this chance to really shine. And it kind of answers the prompt of the movie in a very, you know, in almost a meta way, where it's like, I don't want to watch a movie where 90% of it takes place in my world. Right. I want to watch a movie where much more of it takes place in this incredibly designed plastic Barbie world that just looks so good and fanciful and like this big, you know, cake, essentially. And it really speaks to, I don't know, this longing that you have to, like, the escapist piece, but at the same time is doing all the structural things it needs to be doing.
Yeah, exactly. 1,000% to the point where, like, when I realized they were going to the real world, I was like, oh, well, now we're going to be stuck in the real world until the third act. So that when we got, yeah, so smart to do it because you get the fun. But like you're saying, it's also doing exactly the thematic story work that needs to happen. And again, I was also struggling to, are there any other movies that do it like this? I don't know, but learn, everyone. This is right. A good example.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it, you know, I'm going to bring it back again to the Spider-Verse conversation and the sort of the meta-modern, you know, thing of just like the smart movies these days, not all of them, but like a lot of movies that are sort of trying to be a little subversive right now are saying, you know, you've seen this already, so you don't need to see it again. You know, so I had that sinking feeling when they were going to the real world and then Will Ferrell and the corporate guys wanted to, like, get them. I was like, oh, okay, we're going to do this for the next 45 minutes. And then we didn't, you know, like, even the bad guys closing in was like just funny, goofy, like side comedy almost, you know what I mean? And it's one thing if it's like, I always refer to, like, even when I was a kid, I hated the sort of, like, checking in with the bad guys scenes of movies because they were just, like, so bland and, like, dark. And I was just like, no, I just want to watch, like, I don't know, the Addams Family hang out for a while or whatever. I don't need to see this. And then there's movies like Dark Knight or Black Panther where it's like, oh, no, checking in with the bad guy is, like, sometimes, like, just as good as the rest of the movie. But in this one, I was like, oh, I don't need to see, like, a whole act of running around the real world and what's, like, how, what kind of shenanigans are they getting into, and here come the back. And then the movie knew I didn't want to see that, and then it brought it back into Barbie land, and then we got this third act that was, like, so interesting and so unique, as we're talking about, to this movie, you know. And then talking about the sort of the character, who the character is in the first act, it's funny because on the day we're recording this, I watched Stranger Than Fiction and Up in the Air. And very interesting, both examples of protagonists who have a very clear, this is what I do every day, like, scenario, you know, sort of like my day-to-day routine life, just like Barbie. Except in Stranger Than Fiction, Will Ferrell's character is miserable and, like, wants to change that. He's just doing it because he doesn't really know anything else. And he's sort of waiting for something to come along and bring him out of it. In Up in the Air, Ryan Bingham, George Clooney's character, is convinced that this is perfect for him, you know? And then Barbie almost is this middle thing where it's like, there is no other option, right? It's just, kind of like Elf, kind of like the Lego movie. It's like you have these characters who don't even understand that there is another way to live your life because they are sort of, for lack of a better word, indoctrinated into the society that this is the only thing that it is. So you might love every day of your life, but you might not realize that you would appreciate learning about the real world, learning about other things, learning about things that would then make you be able to experience a more full and rich life. And of course, in Barbie land, a society that is more fulfilling for everybody, because there are people in Barbie land who are sort of maybe not the happiest, you know, including Weird Barbie. And there's sort of like a synthesis needed for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love that as we get into the second act, I love that the movie early in the second act, it resists the temptation to waste a lot of time on a bunch of shenanigans.
Right.
Like, there are some shenanigans, like the fish out of water stuff that I was talking about. You know, there are some, like, similar to how in Elf, right, he goes to New York City and nothing makes sense, and he makes a bunch of crazy decisions and gets hit by a taxi and eats a bunch of gum and vomits in a trash can and all these things. Like, they're all really funny. But, like, typically you get a montage of, like, the shenanigans of the fish that's out of water. And it's just sort of a lot of hitting the same narrative beat over and over again.
Right.
But in the first half of the second act of this, there's so much more jammed in there in terms of themes. Like, the movie isn't just doing shenanigans and hitting this same narrative. Isn't it weird that Barbie's in the real world? She doesn't understand paying for clothes or construction workers. Like, it's instead of just making those jokes and spending time on those jokes, there's also real thematic work that's happening. Yeah. I was really struck by the scene with her talking to the elderly woman at the bus stop. So beautiful.
Yeah.
But even before she stops and looks at that woman and has that moment where she realizes, oh, mortality and also beauty, right? As things change, right? Change is actually beautiful in its own way. And this, you know, the poignant aspects of what being real or that would open up to her. Even before that moment, she sits there and she breathes, right? And she looks at the trees and she sees nature and the natural world. And there are these sort of thematic layers to what happens in a normal, you know, I think the beat is sometimes called fun and games, right? Like in the first half of that first act. And this movie doesn't waste any bit of its narrative real estate. It's packing stuff in, even when it is also being funny and hitting the fun and games beats.
Yeah.
I read a interview with Greta Gerwig where she was saying, you know, there was a lot of conversation about, like, what can we trim to make sure the movie is short enough and well-paced and everything? And there was a conversation about maybe we could trim that scene with the woman on the, you know, at the bus stop. And Greta Gerwig said, if we trim that scene, I don't know what this movie's about.
Good for her.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Oh, so executives.
Smart. I hate it. So jealous.
I don't even think it was necessarily anyone saying, like, you have to cut this scene as much. It was just sort of like, what about this scene? What about the, just that kind of thing? And she almost realized like in the edit, like, oh, wait, this scene is like the thematic core of my movie.
Yeah.
Well, because, yeah, there's so much going on in this movie. And there's this layer that's almost just kind of transcendent about just being alive and the beauty and sadness and joy and everything of just being alive and being a human. And it's so, yeah, it's amazing that, once again, the Barbie movie goes to these transcendent places at a few different points, including the ending. And part of that also layers in with that kind of journey from childhood to adulthood as well. You know, that's part of the growing up and your consciousness expanding and realizing just all the facets of life, not just the kind of happy childhood bubble that you were in, and accepting it and wanting it and moving forward into it and going to the gynecologist eventually if you're a woman. it really plugged into me this time, you know, just like this movie is in so many ways about a girl becoming a woman and like the awakening from the innocence of childhood into the real world. And it includes the almost like the spiritual existential layer of all that, which is, wow, crazy. Once again, the Mattel Barbie movie.
Yeah, I love the ending of this movie being like, I want to not know what I want to do next. And I want that to be okay. Like, I need that to be, you know,
right,
what's going on.
Thematically, it reminds me a little bit of Soul, which we've talked about before.
Yes, I was thinking about Soul.
But yeah, I think there's this dual, like, sort of themes here that I think are intimately connected, but it's not just gender roles, right? And what do we do with that? With the fact that there is historical, very deeply entrenched oppression and imbalance in the way that men have treated women from very, very early in human history. So there's that. But then there's also, Barbie herself has to go on this journey of choosing to live, not just in a world where oppression is real, but in a world where death is real. There's a very existential question, as you're pointing out, Alex. And so those themes, you know, are intimately connected in the way that the character arcs are eventually explored. But again, going back to that scene at the bus stop, you can't just have Barbie going like, those construction workers said nasty things to me, and Ken going like, patriarchy, horses, trucks. You can't only have that, or I guess you could, but it would really diminish what this movie is capable of exploring. And so I'm so, so, so happy that the ending of the movie goes to where it goes, with Barbie sitting there realizing, okay, you know, choosing all of this, like, life in its complexity. It's not just about being a woman, but it's about choosing human, to be a human and to be a person that eventually will die, but is going to have these other experiences that are richer in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it all ties in with a really strong theme I got from the movie, which is, it, you know, we're engaging with this symbol of womanhood, of, you know, Barbie as like this ultimate pop culture symbol of a woman. And like, can women just be a person? Can women just, can you just, yeah, be a person who is alive and complicated, and you're just a person? And all these contradictory images and like symbols and memes, and can you just be a freaking person? And I think that's also what feels so honest and beautiful about that existential layer.
I love how feminists have just been screaming, women are people, into the right, void for hundreds right, of years, and men somehow still find that really threatening.
Right. And I love, I mean, there's so many great lines in this, but one of the, you know, I don't know if it's, I can't remember exactly if it's part of the America Ferrera kind of monologue about it, but just like talking about all the different pressures and things that people project onto Barbie, and like, and that's a yes, toy. Like, that's just a simple, like, that's not even a, right, like, that was really powerful to me. And then the Ruth character, like, I think the supporting characters, yeah, in this movie, I think, are, yeah, really artfully designed and utilized. But introducing Ruth at the midpoint as Barbie's kind of like scurrying away and like gets a, like, a moment of refuge and kind of gets like a little hint of the truth, like all good midpoints should do. It's beautiful. But then all of that coming back to, you know, she changes Barbie land and Ken is kind of healed and everyone kind of gets, you know, evolves and synthesizes lessons and moves forward. But I love, as we're talking about, that Barbie's journey goes even a step further to this kind of human thing. And I think my favorite line is from that Ruth character saying, like, we make up things like patriarchy and Barbie to deal with the uncomfortableness of being human. And like, that to me just felt like that transcendent extra layer that we're talking about of like, we're not,
all this is made up.
Yeah. Like, all this, yeah, is made up. Yeah. And it's, I don't want to say like, and we're not just dealing with this thing or that thing, because these are extremely important things, but it's, we're dealing with the lack of equality in our society. And we're dealing with the root of all of that is this uncomfortable thing that is being human, which is something that we all share. And like, that the movie is able to go like ascend all the way to that height while not like misstepping or misfiring and being like treating everyone like well and without malice while dealing with all these messy themes is, again, just this crazy impressive feat, I think, to tell a story, balance all these things, make such a powerful statement, and do it with like humility and love is like, I don't know, it's insane. This movie, mm-hmm, is insane.
Right. I think the first thing, Michael, you said to me when the credits rolled was, I want to know how this movie happened. Like, what was the conversation that like turned into this, right? Because I was thinking about when we talked about Everything Everywhere All at Once, we talked about the daughter and the mother character, you know, Evelyn, and how like, oh, it would have been nice to have like a little more time with them to sort of really establish their relationship, really establish the themes before we then get into everything. And I was feeling that a little bit with the daughter character in this movie, where I was like, oh, she has like this, she's such a strong anti kind of Barbie presence in the first act. And then of course she is the one who says we have to go back to Kenland and you know Kingdom, and you know, save everybody. Like that she has that moment, but I was like, I wanted more. I almost wanted more conflict from her as the voice of like, no, we shouldn't support this idea that is this sort of this impossible image, right? This thing that we've been talking about for decades of like magazines and dolls are like saying like, here's how, you know, women should be and here's how everyone should be and like, here's how to act. And I kind of wanted that daughter to be more of a like a constant conflict throughout the movie about that, and then have her sort of change be earned as the thematic conversation like kind of grew to a head by the end. But it just felt like one of those things where the movie needed her to switch gears so that she could kind of be present in the second half of the movie. So the movie just made her switch gears. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's fine. But I kind of wanted more pushback from her, but I also wonder on a meta level if that was Mattel being like, let's not have a character yelling about how like maybe Barbie's not the best image to be putting out there to the world for half the movie or something. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about that.
That's a really good point that might be a compromise with Mattel, because I actually read that they were not comfortable even with her initial monologue at Barbie at the school. Like Greta had to fight for that. So yeah, having a character trashing Barbie in the movie was already a point of discomfort for Mattel. But I agree with you, Brian. I think that's where there was some stuff in the second half of this movie that didn't feel pitch perfect to me. And her character was one of them, where I thought, yeah, she was a really strong part of this character web, where she's bringing the kind of anti-corporate perspective, which maybe is not possible to have too strong in the corporate movie. But I thought it'd be interesting to see her go on more of a journey as they go into Barbie Land, as they fight back against Kingdom, where she understands the true meaning of Barbie, you know, that Mattel wants us to now have, and you know, but like earn it. Whereas I think in the movie, there's just so much being packed in here. There's not time for all these different subplots to have their full due. But I did notice that it was kind of like all she really needed was to go on the cool, you know, cars and boats. And she's like, hey, this is pretty cool. And like, oh, that sounds pretty cool. You have your own house. And like, that's pretty cool. That thing's neat. And then she's kind of just good with Barbie Land, which didn't feel like the character I had met in the school. So
I agree that it happens quickly and that she's an interesting character, and thus like I would have loved more time with her and for her. I think what worked for me was that the reason she voices for changing and saying that we want to go, you know, we got to go back, is that she sees how her mother is behaving, and that it's like all of this has brought out the true like woman inside her mother. Mm-hmm, and right. She says, yeah, something about like, it, you know, let you be like the true like weirdo that you are. Right. And so if you have to have a quick change, it felt like a motivation that cut straight to like the theme for all of it. And I bought that meaning for it. Of like, maybe she doesn't believe in Barbie and now she's going to walk around wearing pink, but she sees how important this is to someone she loves and how it lets them be their true self. And so I'm on this ride to support, because she's in a lot of ways the most put together and like even keel person in the right. movie. Like she knows right. who she is, and she's like just trying to like help everyone deal with their stuff. So yeah, I like that it was at least in support of something that felt earned to me and established with the mom character.
Yeah. And to be clear, her character is there in service of Gloria, of the mom character, right? Who is sort of like the thematic core of this movie in a lot of ways.
That's what I was going to say, which is that I think you're presented with this challenge of, okay, so the plot is Barbie has to go into the real world and meet the girl who's playing with her in order to whatever, fix the space-time continuum, etc. But what you want to do in order to be even-handed, as well as expressing, you know, some complexity to this idea of Barbie and her influence on the world historically, is you kind of have to have multiple women with a variety of relationships with that idea. And so what you give us is this mother-daughter story. And it is certainly the mother-daughter relationship, and that story is very tertiary to the rest of like Barbie's arc, Ken's arc, all of this stuff.
But I do appreciate the note that Sasha brings to this. And I think it just, again, the way that it adds dimension to different women and probably women split along generational lines, let's be honest, are going to have different relationships with this idea of womanhood. And not just this particular idea, Barbie, but ideas throughout history of what womanhood is and different expectations that have been placed on women throughout history. So Sasha, as a modern teenager, again, is very put together and knows who she is and isn't grappling with the same pressures that her mom was facing. And Barbie, when her mom was young, provided like an outlet for her, all of her angst probably, or even just her hopes and fears and dreams about womanhood. She meant something different. Womanhood meant something different when the America Ferrera character was young in the movie. And so having a modern teen say, okay, this doesn't mean that much to me, or maybe my idea of womanhood has evolved. But at the same time, I am part of this story. I am part of the evolving story of feminism. I'm part of the evolving story of womanhood. And not excused from its effects, right? The real world is still not perfect for Sasha either. And Barbie has not fixed it, as we find out very harshly. And neither has Sasha's generation inherited, like, some kind of, you know, magic wand that's going to correct everything. Even if Sasha's all the way put together, that doesn't necessarily mean that young women all over the world are all the way put together, or that there isn't still oppression going on. And so I really appreciate that note. I do think it is probably, you know, not the strongest beat in the movie or whatever. And you could have made more of a meal of it if you had more time. I don't know if you need to have made more of a meal out of it, though, considering the other themes that the movie is exploring.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did have a sense of, like, I'm glad that the pace of the movie, it was so good, right? Yeah. So there were definitely times where I was like, oh, I would have maybe liked a little bit more there. Maybe, like, with Ken, there are moments where I would like more. But also, I'm just so entertained from every moment that it's like we don't have to slow down too much to do that. It's like the first movie under 2 hours I've seen in years.
Right. Yeah.
And also, sorry, I just want to also praise that a big part of the gender role sort of patriarchy problems that the movie does textually engage with, a lot of those are perpetuated by women, right? Against other women. And so we don't see a lot of pressure coming from her mother onto Sasha to be X, Y, or Z kind of woman. But just having a woman on woman, especially an intergenerational relationship in the real world, I think is important in order for it to feel like it's a real conversation about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, again, that's what's so impressive to me about this movie is that they're, you know, toward the end, again, Ruth, who just like spits gems every time she speaks, is like, you know, talking about like ideas are powerful and can kind of like outlive us all. And then that sets up Barbie to be like, I don't want to be the idea. I want to be like the dreamer. Like,
oh, I love that line.
Oh, yeah. So beautiful. Yeah.
And like both of those statements are like true and powerful. And there's a meta thing happening here. If we put on our cynical corporate hats of like, branding, let's change what Barbie means, and now it means this thing.
This is a very smart move by Mattel.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
But I also think I like that this movie finds the honesty with that too, of like what Barbie means and has meant, like has changed and can change, and it is a venue through which people can see themselves or see the world. And so I also like that the America Ferrera character sort of used Barbie as like a creative outlet, like imagining different Barbies. It's sort of, mm-hmm. It was just cool to see, kind of to your point, Trisha, like different relationships with this symbol and how that's what symbols like are useful for in society and in movies. And yeah, just a lot of really smart navigating the meta-ness, but also finding the heart and reality at the center of it.
And going back really quickly to the production design and costume, hair and makeup, all of that stuff,
the scene where Gloria has that whole long monologue, the thing that I noticed most about that scene was that Margot Robbie's not wearing any makeup in that scene. Mm-hmm. And she still looks radiant, like so much so that I suspect that they had to write that line that Helen Mirren says.
That line.
The narrator interjection.
It's the best moment in the movie. It's like, note to the producers, Margot Robbie is the wrong person to cast if you are trying to make this point. But they, you know, they did it. I assume there's none or very, very little makeup on her face in that scene. And as we said earlier, it doesn't worry about the rules. Like in Barbie land, how does Barbie change clothes? Is like, does her face always look one certain way? What is makeup? If she can't drink anything, how does she change her hair? You know, it doesn't get into all of that or why in that scene we see this completely like, you know, vulnerable, raw version of her, as raw as we can. But it's doing all of those choices in service of these themes that it's exploring. And so it isn't just doing them in the dialogue or in the structure, the plot beats, the character work, as we've been highlighting, but it does it all the way down at every level, these themes. And that's when a movie just really shines for me, is when I can look at the image that I'm being shown on the screen of Margot Robbie's unmade up face as Gloria is giving this monologue about the impossibility of what it is to be a woman. And both of those images, the image along with the text, is doing the theme together in a more powerful way than either one of them could do by themselves.
Mm. Yeah. Good directing. That is how you make a good movie.
So I am curious to talk about what I brought up at the beginning, which is the Ken of it all and the Ken and the Kendom of it all, and how that all went down and how his story was resolved.
Go to therapy, Ken. That's kind of how it is resolved.
Sure, that's true. I mean, I think the movie, it feels so honest in Barbie's story, like everything we're talking about, deeply honest and authentic and like, oh my God, you're actually like getting at the things like in a way that only you could, Greta Gerwig. And I think I was wanting to feel that way about, if you're going to have an arc for Ken, I was wanting to feel that same like deep authenticity with his arc, but I personally didn't resonate with it in the same way, where it did feel more silly and dopey and like cartoonish. And even the, you know, it's a big thing in musicals to use a musical number to resolve an arc or to kind of like take someone from one place to another. But I couldn't really parse how his musical number did that or where he ended. And I think what I got from the second viewing was what I was mentioning earlier, which is his version of patriarchy is very silly because it is like a little boy like version of patriarchy. And his journey is almost kind of like mommy issues or kind of something where it's like he's not differentiated from his like maternal figure and he needs to become like his own person. It was kind of what I was getting by the end of he needs to just like form an identity. But I think when I mentioned Get Out earlier, I think the reason why Get Out is one of my favorite movies of all time is that it engaged with racism in this like very of the moment way, where it, you know, it was getting at a liberal racism. It was getting at this, hey, we're done with racism. We elected Obama and, you know, we have all these kind of like cultural lies we tell ourselves about like what we are now. Aren't we so great? But actually it's deeply uncomfortable to be a Black man in the situation. And I think I was a little disappointed that we weren't engaging with patriarchy in that way, or I wasn't feeling it in the Ken storyline. It felt more like a cartoon. Not that there's not outrageously absurd, you know, misogyny online and in our culture still.
Talking about Barbie for one.
Yeah. And maybe this is just me, like in my bubble of my world and my friends, wanting to explore that. And maybe that doesn't need to be explored in a broad movie.
I think it might be more of a takedown of straight patriarchy, Alex.
I was going to say, I agree that it felt like silly and reductive and juvenile.
Yeah.
But also like where it ends up where it's sort of like, Ken, you need to like kind of figure out who you are detached from me. Like,
right.
It definitely resonated with heterosexual teenage Michael,
yes.
whose definition of self-worth was whether or not the girl liked him or not. Like,
right.
I think that's right. a big thing with heterosexual men of just like, I need to be validated by you, your object girl, mean, make my life mean thing.
right.
And I think that's what that's getting at. And I think hits the nail on the head there at the end.
Right. Yeah. I was sitting next to my best friend, and the minute that Ken was like, can I stay over? Because we're boyfriend, girlfriend. And she was like, no, girls. And he was like, oh. And then the minute that like that scene was over and then he was like, I'm going to go discover patriarchy now. She was like, oh, so Ken's just an incel now? And I was like, yeah, I mean, yeah. Because his journey is specifically framed as being in the context of desiring Barbie to define him, right? Helen Mirren's character, the narrator, says in the text,
right.
Barbie has a good day every day. Ken only has a good day if Barbie looks at him.
Right.
And so, Alex, perhaps you have never felt that, per se.
That's a deficiency in my life experience of not having that specific problem with women.
Yeah. But it is a very real way that patriarchy harms men and poisons male-female relationships in the real world. Because, you know, there is this mommy sort of issue where women who are partners to straight men are expected to fulfill like mothering responsibilities to them as well as being their partners.
Right.
And it's a really like, again, there are, I wish that relationships were free of that underlying current in our modern era, but they are not. And so Barbie going like, yeah, I can't be all of these things for you, Ken. Sorry, bye. Not even horses or golf or whatever you want to do can be those things for you. You need to figure that out. Go to therapy, Ken. That actually is a revolutionary thing to say to somebody in that position.
And real quick to bring all this together, I mean, I think it's a little, Alex, what you are thinking about with Ken is a little bit what I was thinking about with the daughter character, which is like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if this was maybe explored into like a little bit deeper? And Michael, to a point you were saying earlier on, it's just like, we're talking about this with the Barbie movie that someone made, right? Like, we're like, hey, wouldn't it be nice if these like incredibly rich and sort of the time and dense, you know, subject matter. Wouldn't it be nice if like it was even more deep and even more rich and even more, it's like, well, we got, hopefully, you know, we can do that later, right? It's just like the fact that this movie is doing so much sometimes at the cost of like certain character arcs or storylines feeling like a little bit thin is like incredible. Like how we just like need to take a second to celebrate that.
Right.
That's what this movie is. This movie is something where we are going into these like really deep nooks and going like, oh man, this could have been a little more fleshed out. It's like, yeah, well, guess what? You got this movie.
I will say, Alex, though, a little bit to your point, the movie does dunk on men here and there in a way that is pretty obvious and reductive.
It's silly. It's I mean, it's funny. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There are some easy dunks on men here. The Matchbox 20 of it all. Is it pretty easy?
I mean, I love that stuff. I mean, my favorite sequence was the tricking the men sequence where it's like the Godfather example, that
so funny.
That was getting into kind of into the more Get Out territory that I was talking about. Like that, that's kind of, I think it was the bigness of the horses and the literal, like, get me a brewski and like, that it was so silly that it was kind of not as it didn't get into like an of the momentness that those other examples 100% went into, which I so loved. And I love the whole sequence where they're all singing in unison on the beach. It's so great.
And I think I get like kind of to your point, Brian, like this is a movie that needs to make a lot of money. It's for a lot of people. There's a lot of kinds of men out there. And so while we may giggle at the jokes about the Godfather and Universal City has it all figured out, like there's LA like jokes.
Century City.
Yeah. Sorry. That makes a lot more sense. Anyway, I feel like those things that might seem foreign to us may not feel as foreign to other people would be my instinct. And again, I love that this movie cares enough to even spend time and go there and give like a nice, honest message to like young men also of like, yeah, go figure out who you are. Like the way that like all these characters seem to find out who they are as like humans. Like the other side of Barbie as an object is that it is there to be looked at by somebody else. And that is also indoctrinating behavior and a mindset. And so like, I like that this movie takes the care to look at both sides of those things and give life lessons to everybody. It's quite a feat. Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from Barbie? Brian, do you want to start us off?
Sure. I have two mini lessons before my main lesson, one of which is Margot Robbie, who like at 33 has maybe the best career anyone's ever had already. Like it's just like wow. Scorsese, Tarantino, like just all over the place and just like knocks it out of the park every single time and can like do anything, like can just like play whatever is needed to be played and just do it perfectly. If you haven't seen Babylon, see it. Margot Robbie. She's kind of like the next Brad Pitt, where it's just like the net person who like everyone wants to work with and can kind of step up to the plate. And like in Babylon, she like literally is the next Brad Pitt. Anyway, but lesson number two, mini lesson is just, I've talked before about how references, especially in like Star Wars or Marvel, like I want them to be done in a way where if you don't know the reference, it doesn't matter. So like Barbie has this whole like Matrix scene with Kate McKinnon where she's like, if you take the Birkenstock, then you get to go to the, and she's like, no, I want to take that. She's like, well, you don't really have a choice. You don't have to have seen the Matrix to absolutely know that that's completely what that's referencing, but you do, but it is. And I think this movie is referencing being there in a moment where Peter Sellers leaves this house, a perfect world that he is in until the inciting incident, just like this movie. And then when he leaves the house, it's playing, the 2001 song, also Sprach Zarathustra, but like with a hip hop beat. And that's, this movie obviously opens with a 2001 sequence. And then when Ken is doing his patriarchy thing, they're playing that version, I think, from being there. And I was like, oh my God, you just did the deepest cut ever. That was like, so for me. And no one needs to know that that was what you were referencing.
It works so well there for that Century City montage when he's just taking in like the Hummer and the cops on horses. It's just so perfect. Yeah.
But to move on to my main lesson, I had also Get Out in my notes, as Alex was saying. And just to sum up my lesson in one sentence, it's sometimes the best way to make a movie about a thing is to just make it about the thing. And when we talked about Get Out, we said, you know, there are horror movies where you say, oh, this person is running from this monster, and that monster is a metaphor for parenthood or that monitor, whatever it is, right? Get Out is like, no, it's just the thing. Like the thing the movie is about is also the thing that the characters are dealing with. And that's what this movie is doing. This movie is about themes that the characters themselves are actually talking about and dealing with. And I think there's a version of this movie where the plot is just some random quest. You know, we all got that sinking feeling. It's like, oh, going to go to the real world, going to be a fish out of water. The bad guys are going to be chasing. And the movie was like, nah, we're going to do that, but like only in a very thin way. So there's a version of this movie where whatever the plot is, it's there. And then the themes are sort of being shoved in to like, oh yeah, the plot is this thing where they, you know, Barbie has to go get this, but like, we're going to really make a theme thing here that if you're paying attention, it's really kind of about this. No, this movie is just, we're going to talk about all of these things. And we are going to, because the movie is actually about those things and not just sort of a metaphor for those things, the characters can talk about these things, and America Ferrera can have her big monologue about this, and Rhea Perlman can have her big monologue about this, and Barbie can have her big monologue about this, because these are conflicts that the characters are actually dealing with. So I think that what that allows you to do is, one, what I just said, which is the characters can actually discuss the theme, which I love. I'm a sucker for a movie where the characters are just sort of pontificating and talking about whatever the movie is actually trying to be about. And two, I think as an audience, it allows us to sort of just relax and say, oh, this movie is just going to this movie is just going to talk to us about this stuff. We don't have to be worrying that's going to be heavy handed or that it's going to be sort of like buried in metaphor. And of course, movies do that really well. Movies do metaphor really well. That's great. There's absolutely room for that. And some of the best movies of all time do all that. But there's something that makes me just sit back and relax as an audience when I go, oh, you are just going to have the characters talk about the thing your movie is actually about. And then I can just actually engage with that and actually pay attention and actually think about that. It allows me to move on to like, what's the next phase of thinking about all of this stuff rather than step one is what is the movie actually talking about? And then you can actually think about what that means, if that makes sense. That was me trying to be eloquent. The end.
No, I totally agree that, like having an undetectable theme is worse than having a too obvious theme. Okay. And I think having an obvious theme and then really having an honest conversation about it with the movie, like that's great. Like that's what we want from stories. And so I think it's, this is me trying to eloquently agree with what you said.
We have a podcast.
Well, this is all related to my lesson, which is about narrators and breaking the fourth wall. Mm-hmm. And like, one of the things I loved most about this movie is that it's under 2 hours long. And the reason that they were able to achieve this is because they took some shortcuts to get to the meat of the story, the themes, and the character arcs, as we're talking about. And one of those is that they put a narrator in it. And it's Dame Helen Mirren. She does a great job. The writing's really clever. But it just slices the amount of time that all of that expository information would take down to like 10% of what it would take if you were trying to do it without a narrator. And I'm not saying that's always the solution. It's very frequently not. However, in this case, it works really well because the movie is already playfully engaging with sort of this meta story. And that, again, they're not going to really define the rules of it for us. There's that one moment where Helen Mirren's like, when girls are playing with Barbie, they don't walk them down the stairs and out the door. They just put them where they want them to go. And then she like floats down and gets in the car. They do a tiny bit of it, but really it's mostly just like, here's what it is. This is the plastic world that Barbie lives in. Everything's perfect. Barbie fixed it all. And there's no need for feminism because women are empowered in the real world. That's all. And it takes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, something like that. And that's all it takes because you're using this narrative shortcut to get there. And again, I would rather the movie spend its time doing other things, right? All the nuance and complexity and the like beauty of the way that it discusses these thematic ideas is worth the time, whereas that expository information is not. So let's just get through it. Now, there are other kinds of narrative shortcuts that you could take. This, I think, was absolutely the right call for it. I wonder, I can almost see Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach sitting in front of a computer somewhere in their house, which I'm sure is really nice. But I can just see them going like, are we really going to write a narrator? Like, is there a better way to do this? Probably going back and forth with about 80 different ideas of how to do this. And then just coming back at the simplest solution of like, but wait, we want to do so much with this and we can't waste time doing all of this other stuff. And so brainstorming, I'm sure the brainstorming process happened and this was the most elegant solution that they arrived at. But doing the brainstorming process and then just picking the simplest solution is sometimes the right way to go. And it was absolutely the right way to go in Barbie.
Yeah. I love that I've said this before, that I love movies that just tell you it's a movie and don't like pretend like you're not watching a movie. If you do it like smart and well, and this movie tells you it's a movie, it tells you how to watch it in that opening with that narration like you're talking about.
And Lizzo. And Lizzo. Just there singing about stuff. Yeah, that's happening on screen.
It's using all these cinematic tools to teach you how to watch it, to teach you enough rules that you understand kind of what's happening and why Barbie can fly. And it's just like, okay, cool, we got it. Let's go. And as you're saying, I think it's perfectly fine. So many stories began with like, once upon a time there was like, it's okay for us to know that we're being told a story sometimes. Sometimes that makes us focus even more on the important things like the theme and the meaning. And I think this is a great example of how to do that really well. Alex, what's your list?
One thing that struck me on the second viewing was, I've said layered a lot in this conversation, and there's kind of a midpoint moment for Barbie when she's in the Mattel boardroom and she's given an opportunity to go back home. And there's this device of the box, like the classic iconic Barbie box. And I think it's just a beautiful, perfect moment that represents so much of what works in this movie, which is Greta Gerwig, like, mining every bit of iconic imagery from this IP. You know, the box is the thing in all of our AMC theaters that you can go stand in and take a picture in. That box is iconic in this toy IP. But it's also called, it's also a box. They're saying, Barbie, get back in the box, get in this box. That's thematic right there. She's going into the box. To get in the box, you have to do the toy thing where you like have handcuffs, literally, like with the twist ties. And her choice is to get out of those handcuffs and run out of the box and take a different path. And I just think everything that this movie does well is in that moment, which is it's fulfilling the obligations of being the Barbie movie, which as a piece of IP has to have all of the Barbie imagery. And yet it is thematic. It is symbolic. It is a midpoint decision. It is everything.
And it never comes back, which is like, there's never a point where someone has to get in a box and we find out the magical thing that the box does, right?
Right.
It's serving its thematic purpose. And it's like, you know, iconography, as you're pointing out. And then it's immediately dismissed because narratively it doesn't matter as much as what it's doing in that scene particularly.
Right, right.
And that scene only works because that is a big decision and like a reversal of like what she wants. That scene would feel weird had you cut, for instance, the scene at the bus stop where we're seeing Barbie start to realize there's other things and there's,
right,
yeah, maybe she doesn't want to go home.
And it's also very important in that scene to establish that she would assume, of course, the CEO of the Barbie company would be a woman. Right. And then to get the kind of like, she's being scolded by Will Ferrell's character at, you know, how dare you even bring that up.
I'm happy we got another Will Ferrell doing Will Ferrell in a way that like works, like, because I feel like Will Ferrell just does the Will Ferrell thing a lot of the time, and it worked for me in this movie, and that made like young me happy because I, yeah, I loved Will Ferrell. The Matchbox 20 loving Michael loved the good Will Ferrell being Will Ferrell. Aww. So it's a nice little callback
there. Michael,
yeah, I talked about this already, but the refusal of the call I just really loved in this movie, and I'm still trying to kind of figure out why I like it so much when the protagonist really doesn't want to change. And I think it just, it adds so much meaning to everything else that comes after. And so, we did the video on Children of Men and Logan, like both of those movies, like take a lot of care to be like, the protagonist does not want to change, does not want to leave. Like, I think having that build up to like, how tightly the protagonist is holding on to this idea of themselves is part of what makes the meaning of them ultimately letting go like powerful. And so don't make it too easy on your characters. And I think this kind of goes back to what I've been trying to figure out this season of like, why does it feel so easy when characters fly from the city to the city, or now they just walk from that scene into the scene? Like, it's all just too easy. And when things are easy, they're not meaningful. Mm-hmm. And I love that this movie doesn't make it easy for Barbie from the get-go of like, of course you wouldn't want to change. Everything's perfect for you. But like, you have to. Like, that's, I just love that out the gate, the movie goes that far with it. And so make things really hard for your characters, especially the idea of changing in the first place, because if it's not hard, then there's no meaning when they change. So that's my lesson.
Mm-hmm. Although to be a little bit of a contrarian, they literally travel to like another dimension and it's pretty easy.
Yeah. No, it's like a car to a jet ski. Yeah. To a...
It all looks pretty fun.
Yeah. Just do it again in reverse. Oh, okay.
I know you're being silly, but I think it's the mechanics of moving from place to place isn't ultimately what the thing is. It's like,
of course,
yeah, it's accepting what that means is like extremely difficult. And right. I like,
but I mean, to your point, it was another thing where I was starting to get worried, like, oh, now we have to spend 8 minutes just getting to the real world. And the movie was like, no, that's not interesting. That's not what the movie is about. So like, let's actually get there. Right. So it's like, it's exactly what we're talking about of like, make the things difficult that should be difficult. And then the things that aren't really actually don't do movie things just because movie things are expected. Focus on things when they're actually doing something thematic or doing, you know, interesting character work, interesting plot work, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's characterization happening during that whole travel montage. And it's really, really good. Good times. What else have you guys been watching? Alex, what have you been watching recently?
So I went and saw Past Lives, which I highly recommend. It's the debut film from director Celine Song. And it's just a beautiful movie. It's a simple, beautiful movie about a woman who immigrates to America as a child, had a childhood kind of sweetheart over in Korea, and they reconnect many years later. She's now married. So it's just, it kind of has like a little bit of that, Before Sunset feeling. Not the same kind of real-time conversation thing, but just simple, beautiful movie about very real people just in and life. And I recommend it a lot, Past Lives.
Nice. Cool. Trisha, what have you been watching recently?
Yeah. So I have another female directed movie that I saw recently. It's a Jane Campion film that I'd been meaning to see for a while from 2003 called In the Cut. And if you don't know what that is, it's the Meg Ryan, Mark Ruffalo crime thriller, very R-rated crime thriller where, Meg Ryan plays like this very buttoned up professorish teacher tutor person who gets caught up in like, there's like a spree of murders that's happening like in her neighborhood. And Mark Ruffalo is the detective that's investigating them and they get like romantically involved. But then there's like this very dark, dangerous undercurrent of like, who is the murderer? Probably it's a character in the movie. There's a lot of people are in this movie.
It's a character from a different movie.
Jennifer Jason Leigh is in it. Kevin Bacon is in it. It's wild. It's a really interesting film that I really dug. It was not well received at the time, but I think has been being reevaluated now. And I really love Meg Ryan in it. And Mark Ruffalo's great as always. It's a very dark flip side to Barbie about the relationships between men and women that involve some of the real life context, which is, you know, the old men are afraid that women will reject them and women are afraid that men will murder them. So gets into that in the cut from 03.
I feel like I remember seeing trailers for that and it looked really intense.
Oh, it's super intense, but I really dug it. So
awesome.
Cool. Brian, what have you been watching?
On a different tone and genre level, but in a similar plot level, I watched a pair of what I'm going to call slacker detective movies.
I love those. No, I call them stoner detective movies, but yeah, they're great.
Right. The first is I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which is Melanie Lynskey has her house broken into and she goes on this sort of quest to find out who did it and recruits her weird neighbor, Elijah Wood. And it's just exactly the movie that you would think Elijah Wood would be in. It's just one of those like sort of like weird indie-ish kind of movies. And it's really entertaining and goes to some interesting places. But then the second, it was Under the Silver Lake, which is Andrew Garfield investigating a missing person and just running into weird thing after weird thing. It's one of those movies where the less you know, the better going into it. If you've read any Thomas Pynchon, like The Crying of Lot 49 or Inherent Vice, it feels absolutely like maybe someone made a better Thomas Pynchon movie than Paul Thomas Anderson did. And I don't know if I even think the movie is good, but I think it's really fascinating and very strange. And I'm just down with movies that are bizarre and have like things that people are still unpacking about like, what does this mean? And what is that? And I think this is actually this and who is that character and all that kind of stuff. So just two very strange, but very entertaining movies that are up my alley as someone who likes those things.
It's the director of It Follows, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Under the Silver Lake. Yeah. I loved It Follows.
Nice. Very cool.
Michael,
Yeah, so I'm just going to follow up on two series that were mentioned earlier because I've now completed them. Silo, I finished. Alex mentioned it way back when in our episode of The Last of Us. Silo had a great pilot episode. It got not as great and not as fast-paced as time went on. But if you make it to the end, it did kind of like nail some cool vibes toward the end of that, the finale. So just want to report back on that, that I'm probably going to watch season two because I'm curious to see where that goes. So that's my thoughts on Silo.
It is based on a book series. So like there is story. I was just feeling mid-season, you could probably speed up this existing story into less episodes.
A little bit of that. Yeah. Stretch it so you can subscribe for more months. And then Black Mirror, I mentioned that I'd started that a couple episodes ago. I've since finished Black Mirror, and I was happy to report that like half of the episodes are like really Black Mirror-y and really fun. And there's one called Beyond the Sea with Kate Mara and Aaron Josh Paul Hartnett. And Josh Hartnett. And I was like, Josh Hartnett, what are you doing in this? But like, he was great. And like, the premise was like really interesting and cool. And then I saw Oppenheimer and I was like, Josh Hartnett, what are you
doing? Josh Hartnett's back, baby.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
He's back and has like changed his body type somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did like, he get taller?
Really yeah. into it. Whatever.
Yeah,
it
is. No, I'm super into it.
Yeah. Black Mirror, especially Jonas Awful and Beyond the Sea episodes, I really, really liked. So check those out. Some of the other ones.
They're like not about technology. Is a lot of the other ones this season. Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah.
Two episodes that just really aren't Black Mirror.
Yeah. There's a whole meta conversation to it. Like, what is Black Mirror really about? And if it's not about technology, is it a Black Mirror episode? What makes it a Black Mirror episode? Right. Like, should it be about technology? And if technology changes, like, can
we should talk about Black Mirror someday.
Yeah, that could be fun. We did an episode on that way back when. Yeah. Okay, well, we did it, guys. We're now here at the end of our Summer Impossible season. It has been quite a ride, really fun. I'm glad we got to climax here with Barbie. This was, yeah, not going into this summer. I wasn't necessarily a huge fan of like Spider-Verse and had no idea like what I would feel about Barbie. And it's so cool to walk away from the summer season with like two of my new favorite movies having come out of this. Mm-hmm. And Dead Reckoning was fun. We were hard on it.
Listen, I saw it again and I loved it the second time because I knew exactly what it was and I just like enjoyed the hell out of it. So, you know, all the weird, dumb AI stuff, whatever. The train was great.
There you go. Exactly.
Put it on the poster.
Perfect. That train was great.
So, yes, as a reminder, if you do want to hear our thoughts on Oppenheimer and share your thoughts on Oppenheimer, go to the Beyond Screenplay Patreon. And we're having a film club meeting with our top tier patrons August 12th.
You guys, I have so many thoughts on Oppenheimer.
I got to see it again before we talk about it because there's so much.
Thoughts will be had. Yeah. Thoughts will be shared. There are many of them.
A certain club got bigger. You know, the things have happened.
Yes. Also, if you want to make sure you keep hearing new episodes from us, sign up for our $2 tier of Patreon, where we will continue to release patron exclusives leading up to our next upcoming season. And if you want to be in the know and stay up to date with all of those details, then you can join our Patreon for free and we will give you updates and announce the plan as we grow nearer to the launch of that next season. I want to say thank you, as always, to the patrons that make this show possible. You guys are awesome. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major. Thank you to our editors, Donovan Bullen, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. All of our X handles are in the show notes. What's it called? Twitter, X, what the, I don't know what's happening. Send us a tweet and say hi.
Or send us a just
an X, or yeah.
Send us a paper airplane.
Or you should thread us instead. And we'll see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye.